Let us begin. We'll begin with the most famous question concerning Hanukkah. It dates all the way to the Beis Yosef, and there are a plethora of answers to this question. I want to explore a rather uncommon answer to this question. It's a classical answer, but it's an uncommon one. And the Beis Yosef raised the issue of why we have 8 days of Hanukkah. The Nes L'chaira would seem to have been 7 days long. So we have, as I said, a plethora of answers. Among the classic answers is they poured in all the oil and only 1/8 burned the first day. And then it kept burning 1/8, 1/8, 1/8. So that's why it was miraculous. Some want to say that they poured in only 1/8 of the oil and it burned the whole night. They did the same thing. Each one of these answers has certain difficulties with it. It's interesting. You read a Gemara countless times. And one day you read a Gemara and something strikes you about the Gemara that you never saw before. The Gemara says, when it says in Shabbos Chafala from the Reis my Chanukah, so it tells us they found a lepach echad shol shemen shol yemunach b'chay somach shol kayan gadol lo hoye boi lahadlik yom echad nasa bo neis v'hidliku mimenu shmoyne yomim. V'hidliku mimenu seems to indicate from the pach, which would seem to indicate that there was oil left in the pach, just a ha'ara, whatever you could disagree, but in the simple reading of the Gemara, not that they put it all in, but that's, I'm just pointing out, there's something, that word mimenu is something to think about. So, the problems are, if we assume, right, they put in all the oil, so the word mimenu was a little difficult. Hidlik mimenu. The pach was finished, it was gone. Maybe mimenu from the oil, I don't know. If they put in only 1/8 of the oil, so then we have a problem. They had a mitzvah to do today. The mitzvah is you have to put a chatzi loig in each of the sockets of the menorah. And it was designed, the halacha states, that it would burn through even the longest wintry nights, which Hanukkah is approaching. The summer nights you don't really need as much, but the shear was made for the winter nights, and that it should burn through the whole night. So if there's a mitzvah to do today, they should have done the mitzvah. Put a pot in oil, filled it up, lit it, and that's it. If you can't do it tomorrow, you can't do it tomorrow. But why aren't you doing the mitzvah today? You have a mitzvah. You have to do the mitzvah today. Who knows? Maybe tomorrow you'll find another pach shemen. Who knows? Maybe you won't. But today there's a mitzvah to do. You have the means to do the mitzvah. You should do the mitzvah. No. I don't think so. But we're going to come back to that because the truth is, as we're going to see, there was a kiyum mitzvah. Anyhow, we're going to come to this soon.
Is it the sheer oil or the amount of time it's going to burn?
It's a sheer of oil. It's designed to burn till the morning, and even in wintry, long winter nights.
If you knew the morning,
I guess, but there was a normal amount. That was, you know, how you going to know? Now, one of the mysteries of this Gemara is why it had Chesom HaShel Kohen Gadol. Why it had a seal of the Kohen Gadol? The Kohen Gadol had nothing to do with this oil. It was, we don't find any place that he was responsible for the production, that he oversaw the production. It was not even necessarily his mitzvah. Any Kohen could light the menorah. I mean, the Kohen Gadol always had the right, but that was true of every Avodah, to pull rank and show up and say he wants to do this Avodah, and that's it, and knock off anyone in the Mishmar and take over and do the Avodah for this particular day. That was his chus. But what did this have to do with the Kohen Gadol? We don't find any source that the Kohen Gadol was the one that was responsible for this oil. So it's interesting. The Sefer Shabbos Shalmi quotes, cites, there's a Girsa of the Shiltas in the Gemara as a different Girsa than we have. And that Girsa states the following. We have an argument with Ohoyabo Elo Lahad Likyom Echod, and their text was with Ohoyabo Lahad Likyom Echod, or Afilu Yom Echod. They didn't even have enough oil for one day. So that's why 8 days are a miracle. So the Shaila, what was this oil? He says, the oil was Bechaisomo Shekoyen Godel. What was it? The Kohen Gadol had one responsibility in the Beis HaMikdash every day that it was Mechuyev to do. We had to bring the Minchas Chavitin. And for the Minchas Chavitin, we needed three lugim of oil. That's what was in half for the morning, half for the night. So that would make sense that it had the Chesim of the Kohen Gadol because it was for his personal use, for his personal carbon. Now the problem is three lug is short by a half a lug. The amount that you need. You needed 3.5 luk for the menorah, and they only had 3 luk. So it would come out that they were short even for the first day. So l'chayra, what did they do? So they put in oil, they filled up the cups, each one 7/8 of the way, and they lit it. And miraculously, it burned, you know, for 8 days. So there were 8 miracles. That's what he says. The Shiloh with this is, again, the same Shiloh. I mean, the Shiloh is why they filled it up in the manner that they did. For what reason? If you don't have the shear and you're not going to do the mitzvah, so why better lighting the menorah altogether?
So these were all the seven arms of the menorah?
Yeah, but they couldn't fill them up all the way. They could only fill them up most of the way. They were short. They were short 1/7 of the oil, so each one got 6/7. I should say not 7/8, 6/7. And they're cheshbon. So Shaila is, so what are they light? So we could learn 2 different ways, perhaps. One is that Moshe Feinstein, that's all right, and it's Dorosh Moshe, that let's say a person can't eat a kezias matzah, can't eat a kezias mara, it's for his health, he can't do such a thing. Nevertheless, if he can have a little snip, he should take a little snip to associate with the mitzvah as much as possible. Yeah, even a chatzis shir, a fraction of a shir. You don't make a brocha, but nevertheless, it's an appropriate practice, he feels. So maybe that's what they were able to do. They lit up the menorah. And listen, okay, we can't be yaitze, but at least we'll zeichel migdash. That's one mahalach we could learn. But that opens itself up to a question. And the question is the question that the Pnei Yeshua raised. The Pnei Yeshua raised the following question. That in the Shulchan Aruch we have a whole many tiers of halacha, l'chatchila, all types of things. But this all stems from the fact because of the differing approaches of Rishonim to understanding the different Gemaras. But in the Gemara itself, we don't find such a thing. In the Gemara, there's a din, you have to do it, and if you don't do it, sometimes you yaitzi b'di'evet, and sometimes you're not yaitzi b'di'evet, but that's it. But we don't have all different tiers. The exception to this is Hanukkah. Hanukkah we have simple means of being yaitzi. Take one candle, light it in your house, and the whole family is yaitzi with that one candle. Repeat for every night of Hanukkah the same one candle over. So you need 8 candles for Hanukkah, and shalom, you yaitzi the mitzvah.
Yeah. I'm a little stuck on something. First of all, can goyim be metame anything? And second of all,
of course, yeah, goyim could be metame, yes.
They don't carry tumah and they don't have
Thomas Medris, whatever it is, okay. That it could mean.
Second of all, this is I don't know if you call this mashkir or if you call this open to be metame that.
It's also not midoraisa, correct. There's only midorabbanon, tumas mashkin. Whatever, that also factors in. But there are tumas, however it is. It means that Bikuru was rendered, and whatever they did, they rendered it unfit or inappropriate to be used in the Migdash. You're true in all your ha'aras. So the Shaila is, so why do we have these 3 tiers? So the Pnei Yeshua says, because in reality there was no problem. We could have taken tumah oil and lit it. Because we have a principle of tumah hutra b'tzibur, meaning if the tzibur has no other means of doing the mitzvah other than doing it b'tumah, they're allowed to do it even if they're tumah. So if the oil's tummy, so they can light with tummy oil, he says. So what was the problem? The problem is they didn't want to do that. They had now the opportunity to be Mekayim, the Hadlok and the Migdash. They wanted to be Mekayim at the right way. So they searched and they searched and they searched, and Baruch Hashem, they found, on that day that they were searching, they found one vial of oil. So he says, since they looked to be Mekayim the Mitzvah at the highest level, they didn't want to just be Yotze, which they could easily have done. So Mameila, that's why we have, the Halach also has varied levels of Kiyum for that reason, because this is similar to what Klal Yisrael did in its lighting of the menorah in the Migdash. So now we have now the problem increases now. If they didn't put in all the oil, enough oil, so why didn't they put in enough oil? If you don't have enough oil to light with oil, that's tar, so put in tummy dika oil. And you'll also be yitzir a mitzvah. So what right did they have to just put in the tar oil and not get involved with the tummy oil if they needed to use the tummy oil to be mekayim the mitzvah? So it's altogether strange what they did. Now we could speculate the following. We could speculate in the following manner. That we have a shaila in the Gemara of kopsa zokukla, kopsa in zokukla, meaning I lit the menorah. Conditions seem to be appropriate. There's no special wind there. I have a good wick. I have good oil. Yesterday it burned for 3 hours. I did the same thing, repeat performance today. In 5 minutes it fizzled out. Do I have to relight it or not? Kopsa zokukla, kopsa in zokukla, no. Now, we should not really use the term Adlok Osem Mitzvah. That's not really the proper term. Adlok Osem Mitzvah really actually means something else. But that's not our concern for the moment. So that's the shay that the Gemara raises. And the Gemara concludes that when Eres Chanukah, the halacha is kopsa in zokuklo. Except, with the notable exception that the Taz makes, that if you're lighting an Erev Shabbos and it blows out before Shkia, and you have enough time to relight it, you mechuyev to relight it. Why is a mystery. Whatever, I have a share on that, but that's for a different time, not for tonight. No, not Shabbos licht. Chanukah licht. No. Shabbos licht would be fine, I understand that, yeah. Oh. So the shayla is, what's the shayla of kopsa zokuklo, kopsa in zokuklo? What is the shayla? What is the shayla? So I think the shayla is the following, that in the Migdash, the halacha is, what happens if the menorah goes out in the Migdash? So there the halacha is kopsa zokuklo, you mechuyev to relight it. So if you come, and 3 hours after you lit it, it's out, the kohen has to relight it. So I think that the shaila in the Gemara is when they, since the Neros Chanukah are to commemorate the mitzvah of the Hadlokah and the Migdash, so how far did they go? Did they go as far as Kopsa Zokuklo? Or they said, no, you have to light. But if Kopsa is ain't Zokuklo, you don't have to, we didn't go to the full 9 yards as we of what the Halacha would have been in the Migdash. I think that's the Gemara shaila. So now we come out, Kopsa ain't Zokuklo. So which means, that's why we come to the following, that you have to have all the oil present at the beginning, because at the moment of the lighting, that's everything. If it blows out 1 minute after, the mitzvah is finished. So I have to have been construed, to have been mekayim the mitzvah, right when I lit. Now, what happens if we'll assume kopsa zokuklo, as in the Migdash? So then the chayra, the moment of the lighting, is I'm not mekayim the mitzvah fully. If it goes out, that's why I have to relight it. So there's another side to that too. The chayra would come out and the Migdash, I don't have to have the whole shir at the beginning. Because it's not the first moment that defines, it's just the, each moment that it burns is the mitzvah. So they could have, now, so why did they light though? So we could say that would explain that you could put in and not put in all the oil and you wait and see what happens. If it works, it works. Or as much as it worked, you will Mekayim B'Tayra. And the rest, you'll be Mekayim B'Tumah, the rest. And thus, lo and behold, they didn't have the need to. But the question is what they were out to be Mekayim. Now, we have a second possibility of what they were out to be Mekayim. One is just to emulate the mitzvah somewhat. But at the end of the day, it's a little odd because they're going to be yotzei the mitzvah even with tumah oil. So we could say, what I would prefer to say is something else. That what they wanted to do is, that when we have to do a mitzvah, our job is to do the hishtadlis, as much as we can do. After that, it's dependent upon the Rabbeinu Shalom, if we succeed or we don't succeed. So they could have said the following. Listen, we're putting in 6/7 of the oil. Now, maybe we'll succeed. Maybe for whatever reasons, the atmospheric conditions, the this conditions, the that conditions will be such that it will burn the whole night. We'll make it the whole night. So we're able to do it. So if it'll go out, we see it's going to go out, so we'll add tummy to oil to finish the mitzvah. But right now, we're going to do the mitzvah with Tyre, and we'll see what happens, especially if they put 1/8 and they were willing to do that. If they put 6/7, you have a shot. You know, if there's a little bit less airflow around it, the wick is a little thinner, the oil for some reason doesn't pull as well in the wick. Yeah.
Isn't that true for any act of free will when you make a choice, and then after you make your choice, God then decides whether that gets counted
out? Yeah, that's true. But normally, you're right. But we associate that normally when I have all the factors present to succeed. So now I make the choice to do it. And then I'm dependent if the Rabbeinu Shalom allows me to succeed. But here we're going even a step beyond that. When I don't have the factors in place to succeed, and I still do the Hishtadlis, and I hope that I'll be merit an extra measure of divine assistance. Now we find, for example, it's a Rashi that I come back to always because it struck me very, very deeply many, many years ago. In Parshas Bamidbar is the Parsha of the census. So first we have the census of the Shvatim, and the Rabbeinu Shalom tells Moshe Rabbeinu, do not include Shevet Levi in that census. Then he instructs him to make a separate census for the Bnei Levi. That is a marked difference between the two. The census of the Klal Yisrael starts from 20 till 60, and what's relevant to us here is that the census of the Bnei Levi starts from 30 days old. So, Moshe Rabbeinu turns to the Rabbeinu Shalom and he says, I don't exactly know how to conduct the census. A 30-day-old child is in his mother's bedroom nursing. So am I to invade the privacy of every young woman that just had a baby? How am I going to go count them? 20-year-old men, yeah, I can meet them. But what am I going to do here? This is a very delicate and sensitive situation. So the question is an excellent question. But the Rabbeinu Shalom is inscrutable. The Rabbeinu Shalom only answers them. It's Rashi and Parshas Bamidbar. It's obviously a Medrash. Asei ato shelcho v'ani aseh sheli. You do what you have to do, and I'll do what I have to do. That doesn't give him much guidance about how he's supposed to solve his dilemma. So what does Moshe Rabbeinu do? Listen, the Rabbeinu Shalom said, I should do what I could do. So he marches off to the first tent of the Bnei Levi. He comes to the first place where there's a young child, and a voice comes out, a heavenly voice rings out and tells him how many people there are in this house that he has to put into the census. But the Rabbeinu Shalom does not tell him beforehand how he is to succeed. And our service of the Rabbeinu Shalom does not demand that we know how we're going to succeed. It only demands of us that we do whatever we think we can do, and then hope that whatever, the siyata d'shmaya, will fall into place even beyond that which I could anticipate. So perhaps that's what they did. They lit the menorah with 6/7 of the oil, and I said, listen, we'll see what happens. If it works, it works. If it doesn't work, we'll dump in the tumah oil. It worked, and it worked. Not only did it work, but it worked so well that it burned for 8 nights. It didn't go out. It really worked. But their lesson was, their undertaking was, that when it comes to mitzvahs, it's our responsibility to do that which we can do in our service of the Rabbeinu Shalom. We have There's a famous mice of the Brisker Rebbe, Revel Soloveitchik Zatzal. He came to shul once in Brisk, and as the davening started in Yom Kippur, there was suddenly a choir rang out from some balcony way, way up in the building. And this was not Revel's idea of davening in Yom Kippur with a choir. So there was a men's section, a couple of ladies' balconies, and over that there was another balcony all the way up where the choir was. So Revel was fasting already the night of Kol Nidre, and he marched up the steps all the way up there, who knows how many flights till he got there, and he told the choir leader to cease and desist. So the choir leader stopped, so he came back downstairs again. Came back downstairs, well, the Rebbe was now 5-6 flights away from him, the choir leader took up again. So Revel marched up again, and this happened a number of times, and the same story. And finally he went up one time, and he came down, and from one of the ladies' sections, the wife of the choir master stuck her head out and yelled up at her husband, "Are you trying to kill the Rav? He was a frail man. He's going to go up and down these so many flights of steps on Yom Kippur like this. He's going to have a heart attack. He's going to die. You're going to kill the Rav." So once his wife told him off, that was, you know, the wife you have to listen to. So that stopped it. That's what happened in Brisk. So Ravel Zatzal used to say the following: why did I go up the last time that I went up? Did I have any expectation that this time he was going to listen to me any more than any other time? No, I had no such expectation. But I evaluated myself, and I decided I have enough strength to climb the steps one more time. And I felt it's my responsibility to protest, which was something inappropriate taking place in the Beis HaKnesses. So I went. That's why I went. Not because I expected to succeed. That was my responsibility, and I was able to execute my responsibility. So I went. Min HaShemayim, the Rebbe Shalom made something happen that I succeeded, but that was not the reason. I did not go because I anticipated success. And that's a very powerful lesson of Hanukkah from this pshat. That it's true in all of life, but it's particularly true in Avodas Hashem. We can have places, things we'd like to accomplish. We're not sure even how to accomplish them. And we see many obstacles along the way. But we can take the first step that we see how we can take. So we take the first step. What happens after the first step? We'll see. Maybe the Rebbeinu Shlomo opens up a new possibility, something that didn't exist before. And I can take a second step. What happens next? Who knows? And in that manner, we go forward. And sometimes in life, we arrive many times at places that we couldn't imagine when we started the journey. How are we going to get there? How are we going to get there? But we look back, and this happened, and that happened, and the third thing, the fourth thing, and so all types of funny things happened along the way, which actually opened the path for me to succeed, to be able to reach the place that I wanted to reach. So this is a very, very important lesson in our personal lives, and it's an extremely important lesson in our national life, in the existence of the Jewish people. When the Chashmonaim undertook to wage war against Antiochus, if you went to Las Vegas and you wanted to put a bet on who's going to win this war, I guarantee you they were taking no bets on Antiochus. You wanted to bet on the Chashmonaim, they'll take as many bets as you want. But on Antiochus, it was closed. You know, they don't take, when something's a sure thing, they don't take bets. They don't let you get away with that. Antiochus had a powerful army, well-trained, and the Chashmonaim were a ragtag bunch. So how in the world did they expect that they're going to defeat Antiochus? But they realized that there's no choice. They have to undertake the battle. What will happen? Probably they'll get killed and lose. Probably. That's probably what's going to happen to them. But nevertheless, that's the call of the hour. So they undertook it. And somehow, they managed to succeed. Now, what we talk about in Hanukkah is the very first step. They managed in Yerushalayim and the environs of the Beis HaMikdash to seize control and push Antiochus out. And they reestablished, they said they rebuilt the Mizbeach at this time. They lit the menorah. Now, this was the heart of Klal Yisrael, Yerushalayim and the Migdash. So in effect, it was like the effect of raising the flag. You know, the famous picture of the soldiers raising the Marines, where they're raising the flag in Iwo Jima. The flag was raised. Suddenly, people had hope. You know, the core of the central nervous system of the Jewish people has been reestablished. So there was hope. So people, obviously, little by little, started to flock to their cause. Now this, according to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, was a lengthy process. It took really to be completed 52 years till they actually rid themselves entirely of the problem. But how did they begin the problem? How did they undertake it? Only by saying, this is what I'm able to do. And after that, we'll have to see what the Rebbeinu Shel Olam does. And they succeeded in magnificent fashion, above and beyond anyone's expectation, in bringing forth this victory. And that's the story of Klal Yisrael throughout our history. The story of Klal Yisrael is, why are we here? And the Chiti are mentioned in Chumash, in association with Abraham Avinu, the Bnei Ches, right? The Chiti. 100 years ago, nobody in the world knew who the Chiti were. They had totally disappeared from the face of this earth. They had been swallowed up by the earth and disappeared. Nobody knew the first thing about them. Who they were, when they were, where they were, what they were. They had tablets, a cuneiform tablet, similar to what they have in Egypt, with some type of hieroglyphics. But no one had been able to break the code of what they were about. And some scholar in the 1930s was studying them, and he got a blitz, and he was able to interpret one sentence. And from that, he was able to expand outward and start to understand, and they deciphered their tablets. So what did we find out about them? That they were an ancient people. They came from somewhere in Turkey, a very powerful and aggressive people. They controlled a huge part of the Middle East, as we find in the time of Avraham Avinu. And maybe 2,500 years ago or so, whatever it is, they were defeated, and they disappeared, and the earth covered them over. And there was no remnant of the society left, nothing. Nobody in the world knew about them. Yes, this Tachit. Some people mentioned in the Bible, but it's other than that, in history, we don't know anything about them. Nothing was left to them. Nothing. Not a temple, not a book, nothing. Totally disappeared, swallowed up by the earth.
What are they called?
Chiti. Hittites in English. Hittites.
Oh, Hittites.
The Hittites, yeah. Totally swallowed up by the earth. 100 years ago, nobody knew anything about them. If you wanted to come as a wise guy, a star, and say they didn't exist, you could have gotten away with that too. If we take a measure of the Jewish people, 1900 years, right, until the establishment of the State of Israel, there was no state, so there was no central government for the Jewish people. There was no common language. There was no common geography. We were spread over the face of the earth. We were the ultimate outsider in every society, persecuted. And beyond that, we had no central religious authority. Now, how in the world is a people supposed to survive as a people with no common language, no central government, no central religious authority, no common geography? It defies all the rules of history. We should have read about Abraham and the man said, "Oh, wonder what happened to his people. Where'd they go?" And instead, we're around. Strange. It's one of the mysteries of history. Even the secular people, Ben Gurion, was fascinated by this question: what accounted for the survival of the Jewish people? He understood that the rules of history were not in our favor. But how did we survive? we seized every opportunity that we had to build. We never worried what the past was, what we'd gone through, what had been destroyed. We woke up and said, on tomorrow, what can we build today? Can we build a shul? Can we build a yeshiva? Can we build a mikveh? And we built. There was, in the Gerer Shtibel in Williamsburg, on Ross Street, so there used to be, I don't know if it's still hanging there, I have no idea, but there was a letter written by the Gerer Rebbe, the Imre Emes, in Topshin Vov, right after the war. And he wrote to them the following. He said, it's not our business to be concerned. The past is the past and is gone. That's over. We have to turn our sights to the future and what we're doing, you know, going forward. It took men of great faith to be able to do that. And we were blessed that we had a very small number but of people, but of such phenomenal faith. And they could step out of the ashes of the Holocaust, having suffered grievously themselves, and just embrace the Rabbeinu Shel Olam and embrace Klal Yisrael and go forward. You'd ask them, how are you going to succeed? Klausenberger Rebbe Zatzal, he had the classic statement of it. He decided at a certain point in time that he was in Netanya. He's going to build a hospital for the city of Netanya. So it's today Laniato Hospital. So at that time, there were three proposals from different groups to build a hospital in Netanya. So an emissary of the Ministry of Health in Israel came to the Klausenberger Rebbe, and they said, listen, do us all a favor and pack up on this idea of Laniato Hospital. He says, you have no money. It takes millions of dollars to build a hospital. So how in the world are you going to build a hospital? So the Rebbe answered him. He says, I have to tell you something. He says, how to build with money, I don't know. I never did it in my life. Everything I built was without having money. And what happened at the end of the day? At the end of the day, the other two plans went down the tubes, and Laniato Hospital is the main hospital in Netanya. The hospital stands. That's a person of absolute faith. How I'm going to get there, I haven't the foggiest idea how I'm going to get there. But there's a Rabbeinu Shel Olam. And that Rabbeinu Shel Olam is going to tell, he's going to lead me. How? What? When? Where? How should I know? I haven't the foggiest idea. And it doesn't make a difference. I'm undeterred in what I need to do today. This is what I need to do. I'm going to do it. How I'll get there? I don't know. Our Rosh Yeshiva of Henoch Zatzal was very much the same way. I mean, he didn't make 30 yeshivas across America because he had billions of dollars in his back pocket. They were all made on a shoestring. He found enough somehow to justify a beginning. And with that, he was ready to go forward. What's going to happen? How are we going to get through? Who knows? But just have bitachon, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam will stand by you. When I came here and became Rav in the shul, so he used to ask me, he says, did you buy a piece of land? Forget how you're going to put up the building. It's not the problem, though. The problem is the first thing is you need a piece of land. Did you buy a piece of land? You have money for a land? You buy a piece of land. After that, you worry how you're going to get the building up. First, you buy a piece of land. And he made more yeshivas single-handedly than anyone else in the 20th century, in the beginning of the 21st century, unparalleled. So that's a powerful lesson that we learn, that in the national life of Klal Yisrael is also the same way. We have to take the step. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam says, yes, actually, I'll do what's mine. The Yavetz, as I've quoted many times, but I come back to this. I learned this from Rav Henoch Zatzal, and once I finally decided not to be lazy, and you have to not be lazy, because the Yavetz, in the Siddur HaYavetz, the Beis Yaakov, the preface is, I don't know, 15, 25, 30 pages long, very, very long, the preface. And all I knew that this information was in the preface. You know, and it's not written in big letters. It's written in little letters. So I finally searched and searched and searched until I found it. And he says the following. Chay nafshi, he says, I'll swear to you. I told my Talmidim today, I tell you, listen. Tomorrow morning I'm going to come to the yeshiva with a bus at 9:30. Okay? Now, get on the bus and come with me. And I'm going to show you miracles that are greater than the miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Okay, so I'm a serious person. I'm going to come tomorrow at 9:30, right? So I presume you're going to say, listen, you're not going to say you're too busy drinking your coffee and eating a donut for Hanukkah. You're going to run out and jump on the bus with me, right? So the Yaivitz writes in the Siddur Chei Nafshi, he says, I swear to you that the survival of the Jewish people in the diaspora involves greater miracles than the miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Someone that considered Jewish history and the odds of our survival, right? There were the differences in Mitzrayim was Nes Nigla, and in the diaspora and the Golus is Nes Nista. But the Nes Nista was no less impactful than the Nes Nigla. And he said, in fact, it transcended it. Which allows, and he says, but that's not where it ends. He says, that's only part of the story, the Yaivitz says. A greater part of the story is the survival of the Ribbono Shel Olam's Torah in our midst. It's the fact that the Torah survived, that we're studying the Torah of Rabbi Akiva and the Rambam and the Vilna Gaon and the Chofetz Chaim, and we have that Torah undiminished and unaltered. He says, that's a bigger miracle than the survival, the physical survival of the Jewish people. And history teaches this. It's very obvious. In 1850, what was the seat of the Jewish people? Russia. There were 6 million Jews in Russia in 1850. This was the seat of Jewry. It was Russia. Between 1890 and 1910, 1.9 million Jews emigrated from Russia to the United States. The Tsarist pogroms and anti-Semitism were such that one-third of the Jews of Russia emigrated to the United States. Little did they know when they came that they had saved their descendants from the vicissitudes of Soviet communism and Nazism. Neither one was on the horizon when they left. They just saw that life under the Tsar was so intolerable, the pogroms, that they have to leave. So they assure the physical survival of one-third of the Jewish people. Probably what happened in the war is about 2 million were killed in the Soviet Union, 2 million Jews approximately, and 2 million survived, something like that. Now, how about their spiritual state? Their spiritual state was dismal. They came to the United States, and many they were proud to be Jews. They associated with Jews, they were proud to be Jews. But they had no Jewish institutions, nothing to guide them, nothing to lead them. And most of them were basically very unlettered people. If they know most, they know what a daven. So what became of them? What became of them is the mess that's American Jewry today. With, 80% intermarriage in most communities, across the United States. Yes.
Were there decisions, were there rabbis that made decisions that, that religion wasn't that important? I mean, somebody must have decided.
The people, they were not, there are two things. There was not a big rabbinic class of people in the United States. The rabbinic class was really, at that point in time, was still afraid to come here. Because
they had no leadership.
And the second thing is, the second problem that happened when rabbinic leadership did decide to come, most of them were overwhelmed by the circumstances. They could not figure out in this milieu how to project that which they knew in an effective fashion. That is something that came later. In earlier times, only a small number of people succeeded. And over time, we began to be more successful. And I would say that it's probably in the 60s and the 70s that we really first hit our stride in terms of being able to project what we're about to the coming generations. So we see this physical survival of the Jewish people. Baruch Hashem, one third of the Russian Jews came here, and they and their families survived. But spiritually, a wasteland. Many of them had come in, they had been observant even to some extent in Russia before they came. But here, nothing. Nothing. So that's also part of the miracle that we celebrate. When we celebrate Hanukkah, it's the miracle of the survival, not only of the Jewish people, but of the Jewish religion. Right, what are we talking about in Al-Anisim? Is Lashkicham Tarasecho, Lahaviram Mechuke Ritzonecho. They had no problem. They were not racial in the Nazi sense, that they just wanted to kill you because you were Jewish, no matter what. If you were philosophically on their side, that was fine. They had no problem with you. Just if you didn't want to go along with their view of the world, then they were extremely intolerant to the point of death. But if you wanted to go along with their way, they were not racial. They didn't, you know, the Nazis, Yimach Shimon, killed you, a guy, because he had his great-great-grandfather, one of them was Jewish. That was enough, you know, to finish him off, or his great-grandfather, one great-grandfather was Jewish. That was enough, you know, that he was too Jewish to live. The Antiochus was not that way. So the fight was about the Jewish religion. And we succeeded then, and we succeeded against many, many other trials along the way. Against the Roman Empire that decided to eradicate the Jewish religion. The Crusades. And we have untold challenges in our history. But that's the light. The light of Hanukkah is, that's a light. It illuminates. And I think we have to understand, this, with this I'll end, the message of the menorah itself. The menorah and the Mikdash. Inside the Heichal, right, there was the courtyards of the Beis HaMikdash. And there was the Mizbeach, and they brought the Karbonos, etc. Then there was the building, the Heichal. Inside the Heichal, there were four things. There was the Mizbeach Azov, the Mizbeach where they brought the Kohen Gadol brought the Keteres. There was the Shulchan, there was the Menorah, and the Aron was in the Kotchi Kotchim. Those were the vessels, the holy vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, which were contained in the Heichal. So the Gemara says in Baba Basra that Harotza Lahasher, if you want to make money, so tilt a little as you're facing the Mikdash to the northern side. Shahashulchan b'tzofen, the lechem upon him represented earthly endeavors, parnosa. So if you want to succeed and you feel a focus on that, then ask for the brocha that the lechem upon him brings. Harotza Lahachkim, if you want to become wise in Torah, so tilt to the south. Shahamenorah b'dorim, because the menorah represents the light of Torah. So now the shaila is the following. So if there are four utensils, four vessels, holy vessels in the Heichal, so why do two of them represent, why do we need two to represent the Torah? We have the menorah and we have the Aron, which clearly represents the Torah. And furthermore, while one is in the Kotchi Kotchim and one is in the exterior portion, which the Kohen Gadol went to every day. The answer, I believe, is the following. Torah, there are different aspects. There's the study of Torah itself, and that has to be done under the conditions of the greatest sanctity. That it should not be distorted in the least fashion. So we lock it up behind many, many, many closed doors. And Rabbi Gamliel even said, if someone is not Tohu Kabaro, if he is not the person that his outer expressions are consistent with his inner beliefs, I don't even want him to come to the yeshiva. The Torah has to be taught in purity, in a kotchi kotchim. But this another aspect, and that's the Torah which illuminates the path of Klal Yisrael. Torah Lalame, it can't be in a kutcha kutcha. It can't be locked away from the people. It has to be brought to the people. You can't lock it away. That has to be brought outside and bring the illumination of the Torah to Klal Yisrael. And that's what the menorah represented. The menorah represented how the Torah illuminates our lives. And that's the message of Hanukkah, that if we embrace the Rabbeinu Shalom fully and we ask for his siyata dishmaya, and we're willing to take the steps that we can take, so all of Jewish history is a proof that we will succeed. So that's the message that I took from this particular approach to the menorah, that there was not even one day's worth of war, but they kindled the menorah anyhow. They were undaunted. And that's what we're about. We're an undaunted people. That's why we survive. And Be'ezus Hashem, we will survive. The Rabbeinu Shalom has guaranteed us throughout all of history. We're not disappearing from the earth. So that message we should take in our own personal lives, in the lives of Klal Yisrael, not to ever be overwhelmed. Yeah? There are times of sadness, yes. But to embrace life fully and go at it with gusto. And then turn our eyes heavenward and say, Rabbeinu Shalom, we've done us. Now we need you to do your part. Can you hear us all?
So the Lord God, when he put that menorah, he had to be tough on, I'm just putting words together,